Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decaledge podcast, a companion to the Decaledge blog. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. Today's guest is Jordan Scott. Jordan is a poet and the author of 5 books, including Silt, Blurt, Decomp, and Night and Ox, as well as the recently released picture book, A Talk Like a River. I got to tell you up front, Jordan stutters, and he stutters throughout the interview, and he's embraced his stutter in all of his writing. This conversation was really important and personal to me. Most of you don't know and probably won't believe me, but I grew up stuttering as well. For whatever reason, I more or less achieved fluency of speech in my late 20s, but I still stutter today, and it never goes away. And the ability to talk with Jordan about his experiences and mine was really, really important to me, really powerful. For some of you who don't stutter, I think you're going to find parts of this conversation hard to listen to. I know, Jordan knows, we talk about it in the interview, what goes through people's minds when you listen to someone stutter. But please be patient. Please listen to the conversation. It's important, and you need to hear it. As always, everyone, thanks for listening. And with no further buildup, please enjoy my conversation with Jordan Scott. Jordan Scott, welcome to the Decaledge podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a bit of a hard person to find. So it took me a little bit of internet stalking, and I finally found you on Instagram, I think.
But That's right.
I'm grateful to have the opportunity. So I want to ask about your background, but the first thing I think I want to be transparent about is one of my prior guests on the podcast, Roger Hutchison, recommended your book, I Talk Like a River, to me while we were doing his interview. And it is a beautiful book, and I certainly want to discuss it. And I think it's probably your most popular book, but it was really compelling to me because let's be direct, you stutter. And although many people wouldn't believe me, I have grown up stuttering as well. And so that book in particular really resonated with me. I am more or less fluent most of the time these days, and sort of for whatever reason got there when I was in college, but nobody who stutters, I think, ever really stops stuttering. And so it's always present with me. I stuttered on Roger's last name just a moment ago. H's are really hard for me. And so I want to be open and transparent about that. But I also want to be really sensitive to that. I don't believe I've ever spoken to another person, believe it or not, who stuttered. And I don't know if that's super common or not, but at least that was my experience.
I mean, I always grew up being fearful of talking to other people who stutter. And I think that's still a lingers in a way with the book. I Talk Like a River. This is the I'm most definitely talking to more people who stutter than I ever have before, and I think part of that for me is it's difficult to see yourself reflected in someone else. I think that was my anxiety and my avoidance of seeking out or wanting to talk to other people who stutter for so many years. I mean, it's not so much an issue now, I would say, but there still is a level of discomfort because you, when I at least talk to someone who stutters, I see how other people see me, and that can be very painful.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. It can. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me. I think when we stutter, or even when we think we might stutter, there's a sense of shame that comes with that. And I don't understand why or where that comes from, but at least that's how I feel.
I think there's a couple things. I think that there is such a deeply ingrained cultural attitude towards the stutter, or cultural framing of stutterers as being slow, stupid, deceitful, and deviant. Like, if you remember, there was, I mean, every time I would watch a film with someone who stutters, those would often be psychopaths, right? People that would be. I remember watching this one Law and Order episode when I was a kid, and the suspect was fully fluent in for the majority of the time, but once he was caught, he revealed this side of himself, this kind of deviant, that violent side of himself that was, you know, a stuttering mess. So I think that there's, I think that those are the reasons for it, even going back to like the Porky Pig.
Yeah.
Where it's seen as a weakness. It's this awful kind of a collusion between that weakness and being deceitful and slow, but then it's also something to laugh at. Because the sound of a stutter is so different, and because when people stutter, their faces contort as well. So I mean, I think that's why, at least for me, it definitely makes sense that someone would want to be very covert, right?
Yeah. I remember many times as a kid, my grandfather, whom I loved and respected dearly, telling me, just slow down and think about what you want to say.
Right.
And I remember thinking, no, you don't understand. Yeah. I know exactly what I want to say.
Yeah.
That's not the issue at all.
It's so fascinating to me that there is that connection between thought and speech, right? So that if someone hesitates, if someone is disfluent, if someone forgets, that is essentially, right, the idea that your thoughts aren't together, that you're not able to think properly, right? And it's so fascinating when you talk to stutterers, the number one plaint is that collusion, right? People who finish your sentences.
I hate that.
Who insert themselves in your thoughts, right? It's a very aggressive act that people feel is somewhat charitable, right? But if you talk to stutterers, they see it as such an affront, right? I mean, it's sometimes the worst thing.
Yeah. And I don't know that people realize or even can realize it. At least for me, the stutter doesn't happen between my brain and my mouth. It's something that happens in my chest.
Oh, interesting.
My chest tightens, my shoulders contract. It's a feeling of being straitjacketed. And it's just, it's so hard because, like I said, it's not that I don't know what I want to say. And you have this great line in the author's note of your book, Blurt. And I do want to talk about Blurt a little bit later. But you have actually two lines, maybe three, that I underlined. A stutterer's interaction with language is remarkably different from that of persons who don't stutter. And I think that's right. And then you go on to say, stutters dread words. And I don't want people to hear, at least in my case, it's not all words that I dread. There are certain words or certain sounds that H in Roger Hutchison's last name, I cannot, even now, I cannot answer the telephone with the normal salutation that most people use.
Yes.
I cannot.
I do the same thing.
And then you had this line where you say, perversely, they prepare in advance for every conversation. And Jordan, I have to tell you, you were speaking straight to my heart when you wrote that.
That's a real thing, isn't it? It's a real, yeah.
I remember so many times growing up and even as an adult, like being in school and wanting to ask a question or answer a question, but knowing that the words are not going to come.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so I'll just stay quiet.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's a tough way to live.
It's difficult. I mean, it's difficult because you spend, or at least I did as a kid, I'd spend so much time thinking about that. It's kind of, that layered labor that I would go through in a classroom, which was just how you described, where you would want to say something, but then you also think about each one of the syllables that is in your answer, and then understanding which one of those syllables is going to be difficult to say, so trying to find another word for it while simultaneously thinking about what other people are going to say and think, and that happens within a split second, right? It's exhausting, right?
Yes.
Very exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Both mentally and physically, for me at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think let's talk about both your book, I Talk Like a River, which I think is somewhat autobiographical about your childhood, but let's talk as well about Where you grew up and how you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up in Coquitlam, BC, which is a small town outside of Vancouver, BC, that Canada. And at the time, it's changed a lot now, but at the time, the place where I grew up was it's like a suburb at the edge of the world in a way. There was just, that was the only development, and it was just the forest and the mountains behind us, and they just went on forever. And so my childhood was spent spending a lot of time outside, a lot of time in the bush with my parents and my friends. And I stayed there in Coquitlam for a long time. I did elementary school there, did high school there, and university. And then it wasn't until grad school that I moved away. But that's where I stayed. And it was a great place to grow up for the most part.
And so your book, I Talk Like a River, it is somewhat autobiographical, right?
Absolutely. That's something that happened to me as a child, and it actually formed the theoretical structure of Blurt, as well as I Talk Like a River. So it was a profound kind of personal, spiritual, and a poetic moment for me that has kind of carried it still carries me in terms of how I think about stuttering and how I write through it and with it.
And so for people who haven't read the book, you know, it's really you've had a pretty rough day verbally at school, right? You've stuttered a lot. You're a little down on yourself, and your dad takes you to the river, which I think you guys did a lot, kind of skip rocks and walk in the woods. And if I have it right, explains to you, no, there's nothing wrong with you. You just talk differently. Is that fair?
Yeah, and the kind of moment that when he would take me to this river, and he would allow me to be quiet, which was also a real gift. Right, there was always this. There was no pressure ever from him to talk. My dad doesn't say a lot. He's not a big talker. So we would sit in the woods together, or walk together, or fish together for hours and hours and hours, and sometimes not say anything at all. And I said that was a real gift.
Absolutely.
Not for me, right?
Yeah.
And this one day, you know, he pointed to the water and said, "You see how that water moves? That's how you speak." And for that, just opened the world for me. It became in a way like an obsession. I would look at all kinds of movements in that nature, and kind of imagine my mouth kind of suctioned to them, you know, And I took a lot. I took a lot of solace and a moment of solidarity too with something greater, than myself.
Yeah, and it sounds like your dad's an incredibly sensitive person.
Yes, he's intuitive in this really beautiful, quiet way. And that's what I've always appreciated about him. Because, to this day, he's never talked to me about my stutter at all. And I think that, but he's such a loving person. So I think that he never talks about it because for him there's nothing to talk about, which is kind of amazing, right? That it's like this real kind of radical kind of acceptance, right? That he's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jordan, because, my dad is probably the person I want most in the world to impress and most in the world that I want to be proud of me. And he is one of the most difficult people for me to be able to speak fluently about around because of that tension that I bring to the conversation.
Right. Right.
So yeah, that's a real gift.
I understand that. I feel that way around certain people. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me much that someone with a stutter, I think those of us who stutter, and you allude to it a little bit there in the author's note in Blurt, our vocabularies, I think, are necessarily broader than many people. And I think we tend to spend a lot of time thinking and reading. And so it doesn't surprise me that you would leverage those strengths to become a writer. That feels natural to me. But what does surprise me a little is in reading your books, and I have read them and they're all here in front of me, you seem to have embraced the stutter in your writing. You seem to have made that a superpower in a way.
I think for me, it's, so there was this moment when I was in university, and one of my mentors, who is now a great friend and a collaborator, Stephen Collis, I was in the bookstore at the university I was attending, and I saw a poetry, a book that he had written, and it was hilariously, that was in the bargain bin. So I picked it up and I went to his office, and I had these, poems in my hand. And at this time I was just writing about, I think I had these poems about Volkswagen Beetles and something. I forget. And I had one poem in there about stuttering, and I gave this to him, and he said, he said, "Well, come again next week." And when I came the next week, he had one piece of paper and said, "I think you should just write about this." And it was a combination of that and another mentor who I had Lisa Robertson, who kind of, I wouldn't want to say tricked me to read a poem in front of the class, but I kept forgetting it at home. Right. And then on the last day of class, she had it printed out. And so I was on the spot and I read it and I stuttered the whole way through it because I didn't have a chance to rehearse it, which I used to do just endlessly. And she that looked at me in this way that nobody has ever that looked at me, and she just said, "That was fucking brilliant." That's what she said. About that. And so I think that's a long way around of answering your question. I spend so much time with poets, and they really save my life. That community in Vancouver in the 90s and the 2000s, as well as all the other poets that I've read to over the years, they see my stutter as some poetic gift, right? There's an aesthetic to it that reveals so much about language and the body and, you know, and the human condition of struggling for expression and sound and everything. And that's what they gave me. And like, without them, I wouldn't have embraced it. But I really kind of found acceptance and real encouragement and joy within this community. So for me, it's easy to write about the stutter. Like I like it. Like it's something that's important to me. There's so much weight to it beyond my own body, and then, as I said, that's a real gift. Right?
Well, and it's a way of flipping it from being something that, like we talked about before, we can internalize as shameful and making it something to be, in a sense, proud of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like at the beginning of my career as a writer and as a poet, it became something that I was adding to the conversation just by allowing myself to stutter and not trying to be fluent. I was adding something to, like, you know, poetic history or the nature of poetics, right?
Yeah. So I want to be transparent for people listening that may be interested in some of your other books. I think your book, I Talk Like a River, is going to bring an audience to those books that they might not have otherwise gotten. But those are books of poetry, right? Silt, Blurt, Night and Ox, certainly poetry, Decomp, poetic, maybe not poetry. But these are hard books, man. You know, when I read them, you know, they're challenging. They made me think. At times they're hard to read, very different than I Talk Like a River. And so I think people should read them, but they should know, you know, you didn't write 5 picture books.
No.
Let's talk about Blurt for a minute, your second book. I guess 2 things. One is, as I understand it, you wrote that book to be deliberately hard for you to read out loud.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And when I read poetry, I like to read it out loud. And when I read that book, man, that book was hard for me to read out loud too. I kept blocking on words that I haven't blocked on in a long time. So talk about why you would write a book that was deliberately hard for you to read.
I think in a way for me, it was like some kind of an exorcism. I think that I wanted to just completely indulge myself in a way to, like, it's very, that book is very difficult for me to read because it's designed that way. I was really meticulous in how I arranged the words and the sentences so that it would really trigger the parts of language that are hard for me to say. And I did that because I wanted, in a strange way, to feel free. I didn't want to work as hard to kind of feign a fluency. I just wanted to talk the way that I talk. And I also wanted to give other people an idea of what it feels like to stutter, like to kind of create like a stutter in the language system as a whole.
Yeah.
And yeah, what, you know, the strange part about it that I did, that I didn't realize that I was doing, is very, to me anyway, it's very musical and rhythmic. So there is a part of it that does allow me to get through it and to take the joy in the sounds and the rhythm, to kind of create a kind of propulsion, right?
I mean, it's so, for people who haven't read it, you know, I think our brains get used to certain words following other words, and they become easier to pronounce because that's the way the English language works. But this book isn't laid out like that. So there are sentences made of, I mean, the sentences many times are completely nonsensical. These words go together to create a pattern, a rhythm, but to your point, they're also created to force you to block, in a sense. And I think they would be difficult for even a fluent person to read because the words don't normally go together.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that was sort of part of it as well. Right. You know, they're part of what I hope to do.
Yeah. You know? Is to create a stutter in someone who doesn't.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think it works, man.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, you're right that it's difficult. All the books that I've written are difficult. There's a very specific, you know, school of poetry that I that I write within and that I enjoy, right? I take a lot of influence from the language poets or sound poetry, right? But for me, it does come from a place of, I just love language and sound so much, and that's where my heart really beats. That's where I feel most comfortable. And so that's how those books that came out. Right?
Yeah, that really comes across to me, at least in your work. And your poems are mostly quite long, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
Night in Ox, for example, is essentially a single poem that's book length, right?
That's right. Yeah.
That one was really interesting to me as I read it. So most lines, you know, I'm flipping through the books, 75, 78 pages, something like that. Most lines are a single word, sometimes two, maybe three. And what was interesting was, you know, reading it out loud, I'd go for a while, and there was a rhythm, there was a pattern to the words. I liked the sound, but they weren't necessarily comprehensible as a poem or prose. But then all of a sudden I would hit a section and it was like, holy shit, what was that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like to try to, I appreciate that, because that's kind of the thing that I sort of hope to do, is to spend a lot of time dwelling in kind of image, sound, and abstraction, and then come down to this kind of point of scintillation where there's like a lyric eye or just something mundane. Because that book was the, you know, I wrote that book when I had my first son. So I wrote that basically with him on my chest. So the structure of the poem and the short lines become like a kind of you know, just kind of feeling his heartbeat while I held him. And then this sort of overwhelming emotions, as well as the mundane, were all kind of swirling there. Right?
Let's talk for a minute about decomp. So tell me about the idea for this book and how it came about. You mentioned Stephen Collins, or excuse me, Collis earlier. He and you wrote this book together. How did it come about? What did you want to accomplish? Tell me about the book.
Yeah. So my collaborator and I, Stephen Collis, we had this idea that we would take copies of Darwin's Origin of the Species, and we would drive around our province of British Columbia, which has five distinct biospheres within it. So it's quite a unique province in that way, where you do have these kind of very unique micro climates within one space. So we spent a summer driving to all of these places, and we left them copy of the book was open to a random page. We took a GPS reading, and then the year afterwards, we drove back again to collect the rotted books, and we documented that. And the idea was very simply just to see how what nature would rewrite these books, and to also observe the differences in how each biosphere and weather pattern would read the language differently, would pose the language differently. So, for example, in like the desert region of our province, there would be these gorgeous, swirls from being within the sun, or there'd be like rabbit feces on words and letters, and then in some places like the Pacific coast region where there's a lot of rain, it just became part of the landscape. Like you couldn't even see the book or any words at all. So that was the idea for the book. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the way the book is laid out, you have pictures of the books after you've gone back. And then even go so far as to reprint at times what was readable. That's and leave out the things that weren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fascinating kind of experiment.
Yeah, we had I think the best part there was in each one of these distinct places, we would ask other poets and artists to take us on their favorite walks.
So
we could kind of find a place to leave the books. And that was that. So it became like a real expression of community as well.
That's really cool. So I think we jumped ahead a bit at the beginning. How and when did you begin to think, hey, man, maybe being a poet is the path for me?
No, that's my mother. She is a poet. And
really?
Yeah. And she, so our house was just that full with poetry books, mostly the Beat. Particularly, I guess, after the Beat, before the Beat, said poets like Charles Olson and Robert Duncan. So my mother would put poems in my lunchbox when I was a kid. And she helped me write my first poem, which was about Tiananmen Square.
Wow.
And I remember writing the line, I was in grade six, and I said something like, I see a mob crowding angry streets. And I wrote it, and she was sitting beside me, and I started to race angry streets. Why are you doing that? And I said, because streets can't be angry. And she said, of course they can. So that for me was, I remember that experience like it was yesterday. Like it's very kind of, you know, burned in there. And it was one of those experiences which just got me hooked on to that kind of expression. And when I found out about when I discovered or was kind of given like a permission to write about my own stutter, I realized how much your poetry shares with stuttering, like the its attention to sound, a fragment, struggle, a failure. There's just so much, right? So it became a real home for me, that particular genre.
That's cool. Man, your parents sound great.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. Great.
So talk to me, if you would, a little bit about how you go about writing a poem. What is your process like? Where do your ideas come from? How does that work for you?
Yeah. So for me, I'm I like collecting words. So I will spend probably, you know, 3 to 6 months just reading and collecting words and lines and ideas. And then I will type them all out in a Word document. I will print them, and then I'll start writing. So I just open this document, and then I'll have a stack of books beside me, and it becomes like conducting, right? It's a kind of like there's a wonderful randomness to it. I'll just put lines together, get words together, stumble across something I like, just like, you know, just like when you see sometimes, like, you know, crows taking little jewels or rocks back to their nest or something. That's how I write. And then I work through that. I sculpt it so much that it just becomes my own and just becomes something else. And that's how I write. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that.
Well, yeah, thanks for asking.
Tell me, Jordan, tell me about the last book you read.
The last book I read was How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley. Yeah, that's the last book I read. It's a really fantastic that book of the history of water, but also instructions on that what to look for, how to read it, how to understand it, what is water telling you, all the way up from, you know, puddles to the ocean.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds really cool.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. Jordan, as we kind of wrap up here, where can people find out more about you and your work, social media, et cetera? Where can people find that?
Yeah. I think the The place right now is at my Instagram at Squeezed Light. And I also have a website of another project that will also take you to my Instagram and Twitter as well. And that's lanterns at Guantanamo.ca. And that's it.
That's great, man. Jordan, thank you so much for your time and your openness and your creativity. It means a lot to me.
And it means a lot to me that you took the time to read the books and to be open as well. That time is a gift, and it really, especially as a writer, it means the world to me that you would take that time and read and think. I really appreciate it a lot.
Jordan, do you have one of your poems or something you'd like to read?
Let me see if... Oh, yeah, I do have something here. I have a Knight and Ox here.
Yeah, just read a little bit. As we've done these... and I've been fortunate enough to interview some poets, it's always better when we can hear it read in their voice. So if you'd be so kind.
So this is from Night Knox. Besides, it's slaughter I told you about, shy slurp waves. Prosody, proof, bed, blooded, obshite. When we mess around that nebula's wettest cosmonautical imagination is sparrowing our animal alones. Sail, sail, sail. And I think of next August, that thing I want to show you when a fire burns outside, and also the word rocket-propelled heart fatigue is swinge hectograph fire. Early I said it, snickering kilowatt. New throbbing memory swine herd bends into tree, loss of murk grass, the grass face mask now, pancake shaped birds, how space grows now as two wheels within me, body multi sun. The three get moon futurity, our percussive story, sun rose, your head just out between the curio hive on word, the blood, the mellow, uncome lover's dog in gorge, yet fainting body, kelp fit voice in respiratory ways. It was then I tied you to me, tired, that beach crumpled child, filthy in sand, weighs mere lips, my lifelong nuisance is talk. Endure air.
Just a few quick things before you go. First, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Spotify. Commenting on or rating the show would be great too. You can also go to the website, thedecaledge.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode or a blog post. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website or via Instagram at @the_decal_edge. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro and ending music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, The Darmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless.